Last week we talked about the first two parables in Luke chapter 15, the parables of the lost sheep and the lost coin. We said, what if Jesus, when he first told these two stories, what if he wasn't trying to talk about repentance and forgiveness, but instead was actually trying to talk about responsibility, our responsibility to put aside the things that separate us from one another, to seek out those in our families and in our communities who are now lost and strangers to us. What we asked, what if we're not supposed to identify in these stories, not with the lost coin or the lost sheep, but instead with the shepherd and the householder? What if we're supposed to be the ones who ransack our homes and turn over our tables and all of our chairs just to find those among us who are lost? Today's story is the third parable in this trio of parables that Jesus tells. It's the story of the lost son. It's gone down in history as the story of the prodigal son, because it's about a boy who demands half of his father's inheritance and then goes out and squanders it. But just like the parables of last week, the lost sheep and the lost coin, this story about the lost son isn't exactly what we might make of it. In fact, there might even be a good question to ask if we even know who the lost son really is. There was a man, we're told, who had two sons. The younger of them said to his father, "Father, give me the share of the property that will belong to me." So the father divided his property among them. A few days later, the younger son gathered all that he had and traveled to a distant country. And there he squandered his property in dissolute living. When he had spent everything, a severe famine took place throughout the country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him to feed the pigs. He would gladly have filled himself with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to himself, he said, "How many of my father's hired hands have bread enough and to spare? But here I am dying of hunger. I will get up and go to my father, and I will say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me like one of your hired hands.' So he set off and went to his father. But while he was still far off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion. He ran, put his arms around him, and kissed him. Then the son said, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his slaves, 'Quickly, bring out a robe, the best one, put it on him, put a ring on his finger, sandals on his feet, and get the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' And they began to celebrate." This is usually where we stop. The younger son takes his inheritance, runs away to the big city, squanders it all, wasted on sin and sex, only to find himself humbled and crawling back to his father, where he finds forgiveness and love and the biggest party of his life. But the story, the actual story, doesn't end there. Now the man's elder son was in the field, and when he came and approached the house, he heard music and dancing. He called one of the slaves and asked what was going on, and the slave replied, "Your brother has come. Your father has killed the fatted calf because he has got him back safe and sound." Can you imagine for a second? Imagine for a second what it'd be like to be the older son right now. Your brother takes half the inheritance, leaves you with all the work, and after he squandered everything away, he gets a party that nobody remembers to invite you to. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that I think I know how this guy feels. All right, my dad had two sons. Every time I hear this story, there's a picture that pops into my head. You see that? That's me, the one on the left. That's my brother on the right. All right, he's proud. He's holding up a really big catfish and then another one underneath it. He can barely carry that thing. I'm sitting there with this look on my face that's like shooting daggers into whoever told me to stand up there with that little thing that is considered a fish. All right, I think I know what the other brother is feeling a little bit right now. Talking to my family, it seems like everything I did as a kid, especially when it came to fishing, was a competition. My brother, for the longest time, would never go fishing, especially with me. People thought he didn't like to fish because he just didn't do it. And he said, no, I love to fish. I just hate fishing with Jason because he always makes it into a competition. So that was me, all right? So everything I tended to do as a kid turned into this, am I better or worse than the person next to me? For much of my life, it seems, this idea of comparing myself to others ruined my joy, kept me out of the party. And that's exactly what we see in this parable. The older brother, when he heard about the party, became angry. He refused to go in, so his father came out to him, began to plead with him. But he answered, listen, for all these years, I've been working like a slave for you, and I have never disobeyed your command. Yet you have never given me even a young goat so that I might celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours comes back, who has devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fatted calf for him? Then the father said to him, son, you are always with me. All that is mine is yours. But we had to celebrate and rejoice because this brother of yours was dead and has come to life. He was lost and has been found. So let me ask you a question. In this parable of the prodigal son, who really is the one who is lost? Is it the son who went away, squandered all those wealth, or is it the one who stayed home and never felt like he was part of the party? Our penchant for comparison and competition today is more than just keeping up with the Joneses. It's a lot more. One thing I think we've learned about wealth distribution today is that there are always far more Joneses than we realize. Comparisons and competitions are never ending. There's always someone we've got to beat. There's always someone who's richer, more successful, someone who's designed a better project, someone who wrote a better paper, someone who got a better review. When our lives are driven by comparison and competition, our identities are defined by the people we think we're either better than or we're trying to be better than. Comparison turns our brothers and our sisters and our friends into our enemies. Their successes become our failures. Their joys are sorrows. No wonder I think the Apostle Paul, when he's talking about the body, the community, no wonder he says that everyone in a healthy body and community celebrates when others are successful. You see, the story of the prodigal son goes on. The story of the son who goes on and squanders all his wealth has been all a setup, its context for this other part of the story, the part of the older son, where comparison and competition have stolen away the son who no one realized was even lost. Here, after all this while, we finally see the father acting like the shepherd and householder of the two parables before it. The ones who left everything and everyone behind and then looked under the chairs and the tables, went out in the fields to find their lost sheep and their lost coin. But the older son is not a sheep, and he's not a coin. He's not a passive animal. He's not a thing. He has a voice. He has a choice. And all of the joy, the community, and the father's love all of that hinges on what he's going to do. What is he going to do? They're out in the field. What's he going to do? This is a story as old as sin. A man and a woman had two sons, Cain and Abel. Abel was a keeper, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. So it came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground, and Abel on his part brought of the firstlings of his flock and their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and for his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain became very angry. His countenance fell. Then the Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry? Why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will not your countenance be lifted up? If you do not do well, sin is crouching at your door. Its desire is for you, but you must master it." A number of years ago, it was discovered that our brains aren't just one big thinking mass. They're made up of numerous interacting and integrated parts that all work together to produce action and thought. Think of what we come to know as our fight or flight response. You've heard this term, right? Fight or flight? It's an almost immediate physiological reaction we have in response to what we might find harmful or frightening. It's controlled by a part of our brain that we call the amygdala, which is not a character from Star Wars, by the way. The other day, I came home from work, and I walked into the house, and Sarah didn't hear me go in. All right, and I came up behind her, and she was in the back bedroom, and I just stood there in the doorway, and she didn't see me, and she turns around, and I'm there, we're 2 seconds, nobody had been before, and she goes, "Ah!" She turns around, she jumps a mile high. That's the amygdala working, all right? When we get excited or scared, our amygdala takes over, sends signals to the rest of our body, which are then meant to help us take care of the threat. But there's a whole other part of the equation. Remember, the brain has an integrated system. Once the amygdala is triggered, all right, it activates a second part of our brain called the prefrontal cortex. And if any of you is a biologist or a microbiologist and knows 10,000 times more than I do, I'm sorry if I get any of this wrong, but this is the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex, all right? So if the amygdala is the knee-jerk reaction part of our brains, then the prefrontal cortex is the rational, think-it-through part, all right? When Sarah saw me standing there in that doorway where nothing had been 2 seconds before, it was her amygdala that told her to scream and grab a pillow, all right? But it was her prefrontal cortex that told her not to hit me over the head with it, all right? It's the same thing with Cain. When God tells Cain that if he does not do well, then sin is crouching at his door, it's that moment right before Sarah's prefrontal cortex had to decide whether or not to throw a pillow at me. Would Cain allow his anger, his shame, his jealousy over his brother, would he allow it to control him? Or would he master it and return to the joy of being in community? We have a tendency to think of sin as something within us, as something that has a life, a mind of its own. We think of it as something we've got to get rid of if we're ever going to move forward and get better. But that's not right. That's not right. Sin isn't something we are. Sin is something we do. I'll say that again because it's important. Sin isn't something we are, it's something we do. God doesn't tell Cain there's a punishment hanging over his head, so he better tiptoe around making sure he doesn't screw up again. All right, that's not what he says. If Cain's failed sacrifice meant that Cain had sinned, this story wouldn't make any sense, really. Sin, we're told, is only right now, crouching at his door. Crouching at his door. If he chooses to do right, he'll be commended and his countenance will be lifted up. God is a God, we find out. God is a God who is focused not on the problems of our past, but on the possibilities of our present. It's the same thing with the Jesus story of the lost son. Will the elder son let anger and jealousy get the better of him? Or will he rest in his father's love and enjoy the party? All of us know we have garbage. We all know that we're sinful. But the story of Cain and Abel and the story of the lost son, they remind us that we don't have to let this knowledge weigh us down. We aren't slaves to sin because we aren't fighting each other for God's love. Our anger and our shame are misplaced. God's love for us hasn't ever changed. What's changed is how we view ourselves. And this changes the way we sing that song earlier. Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now am found, was blind, but now I see. What has blinded you? Jealousy? Anger? Shame? The good news of the gospel is that God is standing there calling us to rejoin the party, reminding us that sin is just crouching at our door. It's not our master yet. Don't let it become it, he says. My love has always been there. You don't have to earn it, he says. Do what is right, and your countenance will be lifted up. Don't let anger, don't let jealousy, don't let shame, don't let comparison drive you to sin. At the end of the Cain and Abel story, it ends in tragedy. Cain invites his brother into a field, and his jealousy overwhelms him. But at the end of the lost son story, we don't know what happens. Maybe he follows his father back into the house. Maybe he doesn't. What would you do?